From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how the middle class is betting on the stock market. As baby boomers prepare for retirement, they're pouring millions into the market. What does that mean for the boomers' future and for the future of the market? We'll talk with Joe Nocera, correspondent for next week's PBS Frontline documentary on the subject, and financial historian Ron Chernow. Also, is it rude to screen your phone calls through your answering machine? We get advice on proper etiquette in the age of voicemail, email, and cell phones from Judith Martin, otherwise known as Miss Manners. And you didn't need an ocean to enjoy it. Rock historian Ed Ward looks back on surf music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A winter storm is causing many problems as it moves eastward from the southern plains. At least 10 deaths are blamed on road conditions, and thousands of people are without power. Joshua Leves of member station WABE reports from Atlanta.
Heavy rain, ice, and snow are making roads dangerous throughout parts of Texas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Kentucky, and Arkansas. And in Georgia, freezing rain is causing tree limbs to topple onto power lines. The weather has been blamed for scores of traffic accidents in South Carolina as well. Meanwhile, power companies are struggling to restore power to thousands of affected residents. As the storm continues eastward, as much as 8 inches of snow is expected to hit the Tennessee and Ohio valleys and reach as far north as Michigan, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and northern Virginia. Many school systems have shut down throughout the affected areas. The cold weather seems shockingly sudden in the southeast, where temperatures recently ranged from the mid-70s to lower 80s. For National Public Radio, I'm Joshua Leves reporting.
California officials may be forced to drain three reservoirs filled to capacity because of heavy storms that have pounded the region. If they do, they risk more damage to farms, homes, and businesses downstream that have already been inundated. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers requires water to be drained from reservoirs before they reach capacity, and water officials say some rivers, including the Stanislaus and San Joaquin, will be swollen with runoff until February. Boris Yeltsin's cardiologist says the Russian president is in satisfactory condition, although he's in a Moscow hospital with pneumonia. But Yeltsin's political rivals say satisfactory isn't good enough. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Kremlin aides say Yeltsin is being treated for pneumonia with, quote, modern antibiotics. They say his temperature is normal and that his illness has nothing to do with the president's heart bypass surgery in November. American heart specialists confirm that Yeltsin is probably better able to handle pneumonia now that his heart function has improved. But one of Yeltsin's main rivals, former security chief Alexander Lebed, is calling on the 65-year-old president to resign. "There's simply a power vacuum," Lebed told reporters outside his apartment. He called Yeltsin badly ill and said Russia is rudderless after such a long period of uncertainty about the president's health. However, Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin doesn't seem overly concerned. Yeltsin's constitutional successor has gone ahead with a short vacation and is keeping in touch with the president by phone. I'm Andy Bowers in Moscow.
Public hearings on House Speaker Newt Gingrich's admitted ethical violations began on Monday. Outside attorney James Cole will present his findings, and Gingrich's lawyer will speak as well. The hearings are to end by January 17th, and the committee is supposed to recommend a penalty by January 19th. The most likely punishment for Gingrich is a reprimand, which will punish him for bringing discredit upon the House. A more serious punishment, like censure, would force him to resign as Speaker. This is NPR. In NPR's business update on Wall Street, stock prices are up 68.5 points at 6,617. That's record territory. Trading curbs are in effect. Bond prices are also higher today after some economic news from the government. The Labor Department reports a stronger-than-expected increase in December's rate of wholesale inflation. It rose by 0.5%. But most of the advance came in the volatile food and energy sectors, suggesting there was no large increase in the core rate of inflation. Pilots with American Airlines rejected a tentative contract with the carrier. The airline has now canceled a multi-billion-dollar deal to purchase new jets from Boeing. From member station KERA, Bill Zeebel reports.
By a 61-39% margin, members of the Allied Pilots Association turned down the contract tentatively agreed to last September after months of negotiations. The deal would have provided 2% and 3% pay raises into 1999. It also would have allowed American Airlines to be more competitive with its small jet partner, American Eagle. The airline expressed extreme doubt with the union, a sentiment likely shared by Boeing. With the pilots' failure to ratify the tentative agreement, American canceled its order for 103 new jets. The deal, valued at $6.6 billion, might eventually have grown to 630 planes. Contract negotiations now resume. Either side can request a mediator. If that still doesn't help, the union could eventually strike. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Ziebel in Dallas.
The Wall Street Journal reports the Liggett Group is proposing to release sensitive documents to states who are suing the tobacco industry. These papers could give states new material to use in lawsuits against the industry. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology, industry, and economic growth.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A lot of people who never paid attention to the stock market now have investments they carefully follow. And a lot of baby boomers have their retirement money tied up in mutual funds through their 401ks. What all this means for the new investors and for the stock market is the subject of a PBS Frontline documentary next Tuesday. My guests are Joe Nocera, the correspondent for the program, and Ron Chernow, a historian featured in the program. Nocera is editor-at-large at Fortune magazine and author of the book A Piece of the Action, How the Middle Class Joined the Money Class. Chernow writes about the history of banking and finance and is the author of The House of Morgan. I asked Nocera who the newcomers are in the market.
Well, it's primarily middle-class Americans. I mean, really. The stock market of the 1950s entailed maybe somewhere around 10% of the country. And they were primarily wealthy people or, you know, upper middle management types. I mean, if you were in DuPont at the upper levels of the corporation, you had stock in the corporation. What's different today is that there are more households in the stock market than there are households that own personal computers, which is an astounding fact. And it suggests something not just about the sheer numbers of people in the market, but it suggests a quantum change in the way people have come to think about the market, their money, and so on. The market used to be something to be afraid of. And now it's something that people really have come to think of as the financial vehicle that will get us through the day. That's what's really changed, and that's what we were really trying to document in the show.
Joe Nocera, your book of a couple of years ago, A Piece of the Action, was about how the middle class joined the money class. What are some of the things that have brought the middle class into the stock market?
You need to separate it out between two different things. One is the psychology that is driving people into the market, and the second are the vehicles that are enabling people to take advantage of the stock market. The psychology is fairly simple. In American life today, people feel a need to have their money grow. And so they just don't feel that they can get a decent middle-class life, and I'm thinking particularly about educating their kids in college and having enough to retire on with the money they make in their job, which is a dramatically different situation from the way people felt in the 50s during the last big bull market. And so there's this anxiety in the land that's driving people to figure out ways to make money on their money. And clearly, for the last 14 years, the best way to make money on your money is to be in the stock market. The vehicle through which this has become an attractive proposition, especially in the beginnings of the bull market, is the mutual fund. I mean, the mutual fund is actually a wonderful device that sort of suggests to you that, you know, you, an amateur, a non-professional, can turn your money over to a professional and let him do the worrying and the buying and the selling and the figuring out which companies are going to go up and so on and so forth. Of course, we've reached the point here in 1996 and 97 that there are so many mutual funds that it's actually as hard to figure out which mutual fund to be in as it used to be to figure out which stock gave you the best prospect for gain. But it was the attraction of the mutual fund, and mutual fund stars like Peter Lynch, who were sort of homey and interesting and funny, and they bought things you could understand, and they had these incredibly fabulous records, 50% up 1 year, 40% the next, that made people think, huh, I'm going to give my money to Peter Lynch, I'm going to let him make money on my money, and then, all will be well in my life.
Well, getting back to the stock market, a lot of things are changing the nature of the stock market now. One of the big things on the horizon is that this federal advisory panel has just recommended that Social Security money be invested in the market as opposed to just in Treasury bonds where it's traditionally been invested. Now, if that actually comes to pass, it would mean that between $1 and $4 trillion new dollars would be invested in the stock market. And my goodness, what are some of the things that might mean about the market?
Well, let's think about it. We begin with the mere fact that if you put $1 trillion into the market, that will drive stock prices up. I mean, that's what it will do, at least in the short term. Secondly, what bothers me about the idea are the potential political what it suggests about us and where we are. If you have not just 50 million Americans invested in a bull market, but the entire political structure of the United States, everybody in the country, it seems to me that that has a tremendous potential to warp public policy, to drive public policy in such a way as to make sure that stocks don't go down. And to me, that's a classic example of the tail wagging the dog. I mean, do we really want to run our society on the basis of whether stocks keep going up? The other thing that really bothers me about this is that it again reinforces the notion that people just don't believe the stock market will go down anymore. I mean, imagine what would happen, Terry, if we entered a bear market and we had $2 trillion of the Social Security Trust Fund invested in the market. There would be hell to pay. And to me, it just reinforces the idea that we have become so caught up in this idea that this market goes up and up and up that we can't imagine any other scenario.
But let me ask you, if mutual funds are invested in the market and Social Security is invested in the market, isn't that almost a guarantee that the market stays healthy because you've got all this money just coming in? Ron Chernow, what do you think?
Well, it could also be a guarantee that the market becomes overvalued. You know, by many historic measures, the stock market is now at an all-time high. So I don't know that the government wants to provide additional artificial incentives for more cash to flow into the market. I somewhat disagree with Joe as follows. There are actually two proposals about using stocks in Social Security. One is to have the Social Security Trust Fund, which now invests exclusively in Treasury bonds, put a portion in the stock market. I think that if it was a small portion, 10%, 20%, that might provide some good diversification. I feel very differently about the proposals to convert the Social Security system into a kind of almost mandated IRA or mandated 401k plan where people are managing their Social Security money. And what disturbs me about that, Terry, is number one, there are vast differences in the skill and luck that people will have in investing their money. I think that we don't need more incentives to push up stock prices because more demand does not mean that there's more supply. It simply means that more people are buying more overpriced and overvalued stock. And then I think that Joe's point is really a good one. What happens if the baby boom generation begins to retire and there's a severe, treacherous bear market? One of two things would happen. People would either be afraid to sell their stocks and pull money out of those funds, in which case we might have tens of millions of people who are deferring consumption, which would actually deepen the recession. Or you would have people who would sell their stock in order to pay the groceries, but they would suffer an irreversible decrease in their net worth. They're retired. They would never have an opportunity to make that up again. So it would be a permanent loss to them and a permanent loss to the economy. And I fear that our policymakers in Washington are really not going through all the different scenarios that we're talking about here in terms of what the impact would be, not simply on the Social Security, simply, But on the national economy, I think that Joe is right. Just as you don't want to have CEOs who manage their company for the stock price, you don't want to have a president and Federal Reserve Board chairman who manage the national economy for the stock market.
I just wanted to throw in one other thought, which has kind of occurred to me over the last couple of months, which is this. And it underlines at least the part of the Social Security proposal where you're supposed to invest for yourself. And that is, I mean, does it really make sense to create a society where your ability to live a decent life and have a good retirement depends on your ability to pick stocks or mutual funds? I mean, it seems like, to me, that seems nuts. And I'm not anti-stock market or anything like that. It just seems like that your chance at a really good life should not depend on this very arcane and difficult skill.
Right now, I think a lot of people in the middle class feel that the stock market is their only hope for retirement. A lot of people don't have the option of a guaranteed pension. And what they're offered is a 401k kind of plan in which your money is invested in the market. And so, you know, what option do you have if you are investing a lot of your retirement money in the market? Is there a safer way of, you know, a comparatively safe way of going about it?
There really isn't a safer way to grow your money. So, sure, there are safer alternatives like treasury bonds or, you know, bond funds or less risky investment vehicles. But the trade-off always is risk for reward. So if you are in a treasury bond today, you're not going to get the 25-30% that many mutual funds have been returning. And you're certainly not going to get the, you know, even higher returns that some of these technology stocks returned in the past year. People, I believe, are unsatisfied with the idea of 7% on their money.
But, you know, Terry, let me jump in here and make a point. The compounded annual return of the stock market since 1982 has been close to 15%. These are absolutely astounding returns and very, very nice for the people who are invested in the stock market. That 15% has become a kind of benchmark. It's a situation that we probably won't see again for the next 50 years. When you have people making over a 15-year period a 15% return, which is extraordinarily high by historical standards, it tends to make something like a treasury bond look very stodgy and old-fashioned. Now, if you can get, as you can get right now, 6.5% on a treasury bond, and the inflation rate is only a little over 3%, you make a very nice 3% return. And historically, this is not bad. But when the benchmark is 15%, you really look very old-fashioned and old hat sticking with the treasury bond. And so when you go through this kind of boom, one reason that people are pushed into ever more speculative returns is that their whole sense of what constitutes an acceptable return changes and is revised upward. And then they feel really foolish if they're only making 3 or 4% above the inflation rate, when historically, that's not a bad rate.
Ron Chernow and Joe Nocera are my guests. Joe Nocera is correspondent for a PBS Frontline documentary that will be broadcast Tuesday, January 14th. It's called Betting on the Market. Ron Chernow is a historian interviewed in the program and is the author of the book The House of Morgan. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about the market, the middle class's investment in the market, and how the market has been changing. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guests are Joe Nocera and Ron Chernow. Joe Nocera is correspondent for a PBS Frontline documentary that's going to be broadcast Tuesday, January 14th, called Betting on the Market, about the middle class's growing investment in the stock market. Ron Chernow is a guest expert on the program. He's a historian of the stock market and author of the books The House of Morgan and The Warburgs. Ron Chernow, you're a historian of the stock market, and you say that, you know, the American view of the market has really changed early on. You say the stock market was seen as a place for swindlers. What was the image of the stock market early on?
Oh, the stock market was seen as this rather racy and wicked place, and it was mostly urban sophisticates. It was a market that was dominated by professional speculators and those average Americans who felt that the stock market was a game that was rigged against them were correct. This was before the securities laws of the 1930s, so people were trading on inside information. Back in the 1920s, there were over 100 stocks that were openly manipulated in stock pools, and so the little people were generally lambs led to the slaughter. They would get drawn into the stock market in a kind of opportunistic way. There would be a boom. There would be a lot of chatter about stocks. They would begin to invest. They would make money for a while, and then they would always be the last people to head for the exits behind the speculators. This has really changed. It's become so deep and institutionalized and pervasive now that it's very difficult for us to realize the way the stock market was perceived earlier in the century.
What was the impact of the crash of 1929 on investing philosophy and on who invested?
Oh, this, the 1929 crash scared away an entire generation of investors. You know, and you have to realize now it seems like every year the stock market jumps another 1,000 points. It was not until the early 1950s that the Dow Jones Industrial Average regained the point where it had been in late 1929. And so that for the parents of the baby boomers, the 1929 crash was a terrible experience seared into their memory, followed by the Depression, and it made those people congenitally afraid of the stock market and very preoccupied with employment. Then you had the situation, the defining moment for the baby boomers was the great inflation, and it was really the taming of the great inflation in the 1970s that set the stage for the slow growth, low inflation 1980s, 1990s, which are exactly the sort of atmosphere in which stock investing thrives.
Now, you say that the 1987 crash was paradoxically reassuring. How so?
Well, it, unlike the crash of 1929, it did not lead to a depression. It did not lead to a cataclysmic decline in the stock market. And the people who felt like fools in the aftermath of the 87 crash were the ones who had cut and run, the ones who had been able to get through to their brokers and had sold all their stocks or sold their mutual funds, because that market recovered every penny within 15 months and then kept going upward. And so instead of believing that even something as dramatic as a 500-point drop in one day was a bad event for the market, people just saw it as a blip on the radar screen, and we just move right past it. And that ingrained this idea that you know, ultimately the market will just go up. And so if it goes down, you buy on the dips and you don't cut and run. And it really reinforced something the fund industry and the brokerage community had been trying to say for a long time, which was, you know, stay in the market because it will recover. And in that particular time, it really, really did. And that's the sort of subconscious memory, I think, that's driving a lot of stock behavior now.
You know, I'd like you to each sum up for us some of your thoughts about the pros and cons of the middle class's heavy investment in the stock market now.
Well, you know, I think that we've been perhaps stressing the negative too much. There are a lot of wonderful things about having a stock market boom, aside from the fact that everyone collects bigger checks at the end of the month. This has created an extraordinary vibrancy for the American economy. It has meant that all sorts of entrepreneurs and inventors have been able to get funding for biotech, high-tech, hospital care, and all sorts of other things. And so it has been a tremendous tonic for the stock market. My major fear is that people who have been investing in the stock market only since 1990 or since 1982 have experienced a very, very wonderful but extremely atypical period in financial history, and in the long run, it will revert to the norm. And I just hope that those people have not invested all of their life savings in the stock market and won't be rudely surprised as the tone in the market shifts.
Jonah, Sarah?
Well, I also think it's a good thing that the stock market has been, as I like to call it, democratized. I mean, you know, the stock market should not be just for insiders. It should not be for the wealthy. It should be something that the whole society participates in. It gives us all a stake in the economic well-being and health of the country. And you know, I also think that it is a good way for us to have a chance to make our money, some of our money at least, grow faster than it would otherwise. You know, we used to have a very paternalistic economic system where the government basically wanted your money in the bank, getting a regulated interest rates, primarily for the health of the bank, not for the health of your pocketbook. So the breakdown of that paternalism, I think, is a good thing. People should have the right to make their own choices and decisions about where they want to put their money. My view of it is that we are, as a society, as a middle-class society, still on a very steep learning curve about how to do this thing. It's not easy. It's a hard thing to do, to invest. And, you know, we're learning at a kind of a weird time in the market's history where it has created the illusion that it's easier than it actually is, and you can make more than you probably can in the long run. And, you know, I guess what I worry about is that we're going to learn the corrective of that in a harsh way. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but at some point, the market will teach people that it goes down as well as up.
Any final thoughts you want to add?
Well, I think that one important point to make is that there has been a rational basis for this stock market expansion over the last...
You're saying rational.
Rational basis for it, that we have had extremely low inflation. We have had strong, steady growth. It has been an ideal combination for the economy and also for stock market investors. What has developed in time, as Mr. Greenspan said, is an irrational exuberance based on those sound, rational underlying fundamentals. But it hasn't been completely a speculative mania. The speculation has, in fact, been intensified because there are some very good, sound reasons for investing in the stock market over the last 15 years.
So do you, this might be too personal, but do you have retirement money tied up in the market?
You betcha.
I do.
No, we both do. I mean, you know.
No, this is the thing. You're forced to play the game, as we've been saying. You can't not be in the stock market and expect to maintain your standard of living when you retire. So we're all forced into this crazy game, like it or not.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
We've enjoyed it too, Terry. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Joe Nocera is the correspondent for the PBS Frontline documentary Betting on the Market, which will be broadcast Tuesday night. Ron Chernow is banking and finance historian interviewed on the program. He's the author of The House of Morgan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Ghosts of Mississippi, a Rob Reiner film now at theaters everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Sure, call me, but I don't have to answer the telephone. Coming up, Miss Manners offers advice on etiquette in the age of phone machines, cell phones, and email. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward looks back on surf music.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When it comes to communicating long distance, all the rules of the game have changed. Beepers ring in movie theaters. People carry on heated phone conversations at restaurant tables. Office mates read your personal messages that have been faxed to you while you're being dissed in cyberspace. But we don't need to be faced with high-tech anarchy. Miss Manners is on the case. Miss Manners is the persona of Judith Martin, who has spent the past few decades updating the rules of etiquette to keep pace with a constantly changing world. Martin's new book is called Miss Manners Basic Training, Communication. I asked her if it's acceptable to use your phone answering machine to screen calls.
It certainly is. The answering machine has had a very funny life. When it first came in, people were indignant that it existed, and they made that dread charge that you just made. Aha, they screen their calls. And now it's really come around to where people are indignant if someone doesn't have an answering machine. So I had to call back, and they had nothing, no place for me to leave my message. It's a wonderful thing, the answering machine. And of course people want to screen their calls. Nobody wants to live on call all day and all night to whoever wants to dial the number. It's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. You screen your mail, don't you? You don't answer every single letter the minute it arrives, and some things you never answer. The telephone brings a lot of unsolicited calls that certainly need to be screened. But even among those whom we adore and love to talk to, perhaps not right this very minute.
You know, here's the thing. I confess, I sometimes use my home answering machine to screen calls. On the other hand, I really hate it when I'm calling somebody who I know is screening the call, and I feel like, you know, I'm auditioning to see if I'm important enough to have my call accepted.
This is the crux of the etiquette problem. Everybody wants to be able to do what they don't want other people to do to them.
Precisely.
There you have it.
Precisely.
You're not necessarily being auditioned to see how important you are. Suppose the person on the other end is in the middle of dinner or a bath or a romance or a good book or something. Why should you feel that people have to drop everything in order to talk to you? It's probably not that urgent, is it?
Well, you know, at home, you know, at work, I think we're used to you screen your calls, or there's a secretary who's paid to screen them for you. But at home, we were all brought up with the instinct, the phone rings, you pick it up.
I know, and a really rotten system that was, too, that we were brought up on. It's very hard to disabuse people of this idea, but the telephone is by nature a very rude instrument. It always says, I don't care what you're doing, drop everything and attend to me. Now, that's a very rude request. And the taming of it has been long overdue. God bless the answering machine. If you are fortunate enough to have a secretary who does this at work, good for you. It's usually now voicemail does it. But apparently you're not fortunate enough to have a butler who does it at home. So for a comparatively small outlay, you can get an answering machine to do it.
Now, what does Miss Manners think of this? Sometimes people will call when they know the party isn't home, so that they can leave the brief message and then hang up without getting entangled into a long conversation.
Good for them. It's too bad those people don't have pencils and paper, or pens and paper, because they could sit and write a little message. There are very often times when one needs to leave a little message but doesn't need to get involved in a conversation.
So Miss Manners approves of this
Why
use of
not?
The answering machine?
There, we are blessed now with 1,000 different ways of communicating with other people. And the idea, and in fact this is what this book is about, is to select the appropriate one. And you do not always need to have feedback. You don't always need to be in touch instantly. You select the one that disturbs people the least and does the job.
My guest is Judith Martin, and her new book is called Miss Manners, Basic Training, Communication. Miss Manners loathes call waiting. I like call waiting. I mean, I like to have call waiting. I don't like to be interrupted when I'm calling
there
somebody else.
There you have it again, yes. It's rude for other people, but it's fine right. for me because I'm busier than you are. I'm yeah. more important, and so on and so on. Yes.
But it's worth it to me to get interrupted in other people's conversations to know that if someone really needs to reach me when I'm on the phone, they can get through, and I don't have to just, like, not use the phone if I'm expecting a phone call, which is what used to be. Had to, like, just stay away from the phone.
Well, which isn't a bad idea. The principle on which call waiting is based is last come, first served. That is a very unjust principle. And I am not anti-technology.
No, wait, let me stop you. Wait, wait, wait.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm trying to interrupt this man. What am I doing? What have I done?
What are you doing? Yes.
Oh, after you.
I'm not anti-technology. I love all these wonderful new ways we have of communicating. I'm just for using them properly. But the one that has no proper use, except as people are pointing out to me, getting through to the neighbor who's chatting away and doesn't realize his house is on fire. That's what they all claim to have call waiting for. Except for that, there is no polite use of that because it means you drop a person who is talking to you for someone whom you deem more important, or at least full of potential for being more important. It is the electronic equivalent of scanning the room with your eyes at a party while you're talking to one person, hoping you can find somebody better.
Now, you said that call waiting is kind of last come, first served. I disagree a little bit. I think it's like the last person comes in and they take a number. Because when
no, they don't take a number. They have you stop your first call, and you go on. You keep the first person waiting while you attend to the second person. Now they are developing in some areas a system whereby the telephone merely takes a message from the second person while you're on the first call, and you don't interrupt the first call. That's fine.
Right. For me,
it's keeping the first person waiting. It's right. saying, you sit here and do mm-hmm. nothing while I go see what the other possibilities are.
The other day, I called somebody up, and as the phone was ringing, I thought better of it, hung up, and then the person dialed star 69 and called me right back, and I was actually kind of embarrassed.
Yes. Well, you had already disturbed that person, and I'm very wary of this little callback situation, which was really designed to catch criminals who misuse telephones and not to be a kind of fake answering service. But the fact is, if you have dialed someone erroneously and they're right at the phone, as this person obviously was, you can take that extra second and say, I'm terribly sorry.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Judith Martin, and her new book is called Miss Manners, Basic Training, Communication. This is Fresh Air. Back with Judith Martin, who writes the syndicated Miss Manners column, and her new book is about communication. Let's talk about cellular phones. And these are cropping up everywhere now. I've been in the position, I'm sure you have too, of being in a restaurant where the person next to you is carrying on a conversation with their telephone. And boy, the first few times I saw that, it was so odd to me. It's becoming just more routine. But what do you think about that, sitting alone in a restaurant talking on the phone to somebody? You're not being rude to your friends. They're not with you.
That's right. And so why are you paying attention to the person at the next table instead of to your own guest or your own food or your own telephone, perhaps? Telephones are disturbing when people scream into them, in which case the disturbance is talking too loudly, not being on the telephone. There are two mistaken notions about the cellular phone. One is that when there is a new piece of equipment, this is hardly new, but it's still something of a novelty, that there are no etiquette rules, that technology is moving faster than etiquette. No, it's not. I'm keeping up. And in this case, it's a very simple step because what is rude without a cord, with a cord, would also be rude without a cord. The cellular telephone can properly be used when a telephone with a very long cord could be used. Telephones are plugged into restaurant tables for people eating by themselves, and as long as they're not noisy, I don't see anything wrong with it. It would be hideously wrong if there were someone else at the table. Obviously, at least it's obvious to me, a cellular telephone does not belong in a concert hall or a church or at a dinner party any more than one could make a telephone call, if that had been possible, that would disturb other people at such an event with a regular phone.
Now, I'm not sure if this is a question for Miss Manners or not, but I'm sure you've thought this over. In so many corporations and places of business now, you call to find out some information or to talk to someone, and you get the electronic menu. And you can do this for 5, 10, 15 minutes and still not connect to the party or the extension that you need. You keep pressing different buttons and getting connected to more menus and getting different options and pressing more buttons. And I suppose it's saving the corporation a lot of money, but it's wasting you a lot of precious time.
In which case, the corporation isn't going to make money because you're going to get fed up and hang up before it's over. This is just a badly programmed system. It isn't the system itself. That can save a lot of time. If I want to know if a flight I'm meeting or taking is going off on time or arriving on time, I really don't need to have a heart-to-heart talk with the president of the company or anybody else in the company. It's wonderful that they have programmed frequently asked questions with the answers so that people do not need to be disturbed, or planned routing so that you don't have to keep asking people to transfer the calls and then they hang up on you by accident and you have to call back. But if it is an endless line leading nowhere, then it's been badly done.
Judith Martin is my guest. She writes the syndicated Miss Manners column and has a new book called Miss Manners Basic Training Communication. I don't know how much time Miss Manners spends in cyberspace, but what are some of the cyberspace etiquette questions that are coming up now?
Email is a fascinating situation in connection with etiquette because for the first time we have a community that has none of the safeguards, however slight, that ordinary community life has. You can't read someone's body language. You don't know if you've got them by the right name. You certainly don't know people they know and so on. You are dealing not only with strangers, but strangers you can't see and probably never will. And it depends all the more strongly on etiquette. Of all the people in the society who have been going around mindlessly saying, oh, etiquette is an old-fashioned thing, we don't need it anymore, none of those are people who spend any time in cyberspace. They are very etiquette-aware and always writing etiquette rules because the activities that they enjoy in cyberspace can be totally ruined by bad manners. There's an example in the paper today of the Maryland state government had a bulletin board for citizens to make their comments, and people were putting obscene comments on it, and they've had to shut it down. The activity is not possible if people are going to be blatantly rude on it. Not only obscenity, but hogging all the time or trying to sell things to people in a social setting and so on. And the etiquette rules are multiplying in cyberspace. It's a very exciting frontier of etiquette.
You use email a lot?
Yes.
I wonder when you're using email if you use some of the polite formalities that we use in letter writing. Do you write a salutation, dear so-and-so, and a close, you know, fondly, sincerely, thanks?
It's not the same as a letter. It's partway between a letter and a telephone call, really sort of more like a postcard. In more respects than one, in the sense that it's not really private and don't count on its being. The essential ingredients of form for email are the address, of course, proper identification, and identification of the subject matter so that you give people a sense of the priority they need to give it. So that is key, the line, identifying line with email. I do occasionally stick to the dear so-and-so, but that's because I'm a sweet little old-fashioned lady who's fond of old forms that are appropriate for letters but are not necessary on email.
It is so easy to respond to email.
It's too easy. That's the problem.
Right. Well, I'm wondering if you think all messages that are received should be acknowledged, even when there's not much to say except got the message. Is it necessary to say that?
No, this is not like a social letter where you have to write back if you're going to have a correspondence. People will fire off a joke that they heard or pass on a little bit of something quickly, and it does not have to be answered immediately. I thought you were referring to what is a very interesting aspect of this. The ease with which you can send email removes that safety catch that people used to have before they fired off something that was highly emotional, mm-hmm. whether it was anger or passion or whatever. And so I have a rule there that the more emotional the message, the more cumbersome the method by which you have to send it.
That's probably a really good rule. So that means not the phone, not the fax.
Exactly. Because you know how it is. You pick up a telephone, you say something, and you regret it. Well, it's even worse with email. You type something out quickly, and a little itchy finger goes over the send button, and then the whole hand goes over the mouth. What have I done? That moment where you had to actually sit down and write it and then go out and mail it was a wonderful safety catch. Not enough of one, of course, but a good one.
There's a whole Seinfeld episode in which one of the characters spends the episode trying to retrieve a tape in which he left a very embarrassing message, a phone answering machine
yes.
tape.
Well, email is even worse in that respect.
Oh, I know.
Because it goes out all over the place and it remains. Those things can be dug out. People think because they're so fleeting they disappear, but they don't disappear.
So what's your general rule of thumb? You mentioned discretion. Any other rules of thumb in deciding like what the best conveyor of a message is?
Well, you ask yourself, how quickly does this person need to hear this? And you don't overuse the technology just because you want to get through quickly. Now, let me just qualify this for a minute. Email you can send very quickly, but people can read it at their leisure. So that would be it's not a way of tugging people's sleeves as the telephone is and saying, come here right now, drop everything. But the more formal and the more loaded the statement, the more difficulty there should be in putting it down. That's why we have wedding invitations engraved. That takes a very long time. You get to think it over. And you write love letters in your own little hand, and that takes more time than firing them off. But you tell people that their house is on fire by the fastest means possible.
Judith Martin, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. I enjoy being here.
Judith Martin writes the syndicated Miss Manners column. Her new book is called Miss Manners Basic Training Communication.
Schnapps. You talk back to cops. You walk in the room and conversation stops. I can't take you nowhere. No, I can't take you nowhere. You stagger, you sag, you're half in the bag. One glass of beer and you're a total drag. I can't take you nowhere. No, I can't take you nowhere. I buy three or four, you mooch plenty more. The check comes around and you are out the door. I can't take you nowhere. No, I can't take you nowhere.
That's Susanna McCorkle singing a song by Dave Frischberg with Frischberg at the piano. Coming up, surf music. This is Fresh Air. One of the surprise hit movies of 1994 was Pulp Fiction. As a result of the film's success, Quentin Tarantino became the hot director to watch, the career of John Travolta was revived, and surf music from the 60s, featured in the movie, was suddenly in. But our rock historian, Ed Ward, never forgot the sounds of the waves and the music it inspired.
If everybody had an ocean across the USA, then everybody'd be California, you'd see them wearing their baggies, Huarache sandals too, a bushy, bushy blonde hair, surfing USA. You'll catch them surfing at
that. If everybody had an ocean. These words, uttered when the surf music boom was well underway, sum up what captured the imaginations of America's teenagers in the early 60s and propelled a regional fad into a national sound. By the time the British invasion squashed it flat, surf music had reached so far inland that it was possible to see kids driving Woodies, 1950s station wagons with wood trim, with boards strapped to the top, in places like Dayton, Ohio, and Lubbock, Texas. Surfing is centuries old and developed in Hawaii. It was introduced to California in 1907 when George Freeth, a Hawaiian champion, began demonstrating it at Redondo Beach as a way of attracting crowds. It really took off in the 20s when Duke Kahanamoku, an Olympic swimming champion, began shooting the curl in front of wowed spectators. Duke's redwood board weighed over 100 pounds, and it wasn't until post-war technology developed inexpensive lightweight boards that lots of people started surfing. When surfers gathered at the Rendezvous Ballroom in Balboa to work off a hard day's fun, they danced to Dick Dale and the Deltones.
Let's go trekking!
Dale's real name was Mansour, and his Lebanese-American family owned a Greek restaurant at which young Dick played bouzouki and guitar. Encouraged by his father, he built a band and began putting on dances for the surfers and recording on a family-owned label. Dale knew the scene. He himself surfed, and his fellow surfers filled the Rendezvous during 1960 and 61 by the thousands. By the time Let's Go Trippin' hit the charts in late 1961, the record industry in California was ripe for something new after years of domination by slushy pop from the East Coast. Dale and dozens of others were there to give it to them. Thank you. The Shantae's Pipeline pretty much epitomizes surf music. The title evokes a legendary surfing site in Hawaii. It has a Spanish-Arabic feel to it, a legacy of Dick Dale. And the guitar is fed through a Fender reverb unit, the quintessential sound modifier of surf music, which Leo Fender developed for Dale in 1960. Pipeline went on to sell over 1 million copies and charted in England. In 1963, the floodgates opened. Hundreds of surf instrumentals were recorded in California studios, mostly by bands working the surf dance circuit. The Beach Boys, of course, epitomized surf music to many, although few surf records had vocals, and the band quickly moved beyond surfing to more general teen topics. Still, in 1963, they weren't about to forget about the beach in their name. Some say the Kennedy assassination was the event that popped surf music's idyllic bubble, but I think it was just that the forum was so narrow the teens wanted a change, and the Beatles gave it to them. And even though Jimi Hendrix, who used to go see Dick Dale when he was in the Air Force, sneered that we'd never have to hear surf music again, the culture that spawned it continued, and continues, in California. And so does surf music. Not only does this surf version of Dizzy Gillespie's Night in Tunisia date from 1990, but the band, Laika and the Cosmonauts, is Finnish. In the end, though, surf music's real legacy is that it provided white American teenagers with the first pop form that didn't seek to imitate a black one, and created a legion of young guitarists with the technology and the chops to take on the British invasion and what lay beyond. Even Jimi Hendrix could have dug that.
Ed Ward writes about music and is based in Berlin. The music he played came from a box set on Rhino Records called Cowabunga, the Surf Box.
Wipeout!
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from The People vs. Larry Flint, a Milos Forman film now at theaters everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.